It's Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up on Food Friday, the casserole is a timeless Wisconsin dish. We'll talk about your favorite kinds of casserole and get some new recipes to try along the way. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with the history of an iconic beverage.
What's the first drink you think of when you hear this sound? A Pepsi, a Miller Lite, or was it a Jolly Good Soda, a drink that has its roots right here in Wisconsin? A can of Jolly Good Soda is one of the many items included in the Wisconsin 101 Project, which tells the state's history through objects. WPR's Rachel Vasquez visited the Jolly Good plant to reintroduce us to a Midwestern favorite.
If you're having trouble remembering Jolly Good, maybe this will ring a bell.
The next time you're in a food store buying cola, root beer, orange, or any flavored soda, take a good look at the price. I mean a really good look. At Jolly Good, we believe in quality, but we also believe in value. We want you to get your money's worth.
Jolly Good was beloved by Midwesterners in its heyday. Queer Foods started the brand in the 1970s in Belgium, Wisconsin. But after decades of filling fridges across the region, competition from the big soda companies edged them out. They sold the last case of Jolly Good in 2007. But then 2013 rolled around, and an uncle and his nephew had an idea.
The term craft became very popular in the beer industry. Was there some opportunity for us to play off that niche?
That's John Rassel, the nephew of the pair, and now the president of Queer Foods. His uncle, Bruce Queer, headed the company before him.
He was the one that really propelled Jolly Good to what it was.
The two talked about if they could relaunch the brand and how it would work. Soon enough, they had a shot at putting it back on store shelves.
So we just decided to make a small batch and see what happens.
Rassel says their first big win was getting Jolly Good into Piggly Wiggly. But before long, they were selling in retailers like Woodman's Markets, Sendix, and now their latest retail partner, Festival Foods.
Right now, I think we would deem it as a success.
Today, the company makes Jolly Good at their facility in the small community of Random Lake, about 20 miles outside of Sheboygan. They produce 8 regular flavors and 7 diet, including cherry, cream, and the beloved Sour Power. Before the cans get to you, each and every one goes through a special process. First, they mix it all up in a place they call the batch room.
So we have 2 8,000-gallon tanks and then 2 6,000-gallon tanks. So we batch the liquid back here, and then we send it out to the filler to be put into the cans.
Next, some tests to make sure it's all up to snuff, and then all of that soda and a bunch of empty cans are sent to the filler room, which always smells like whatever flavor is being filled. That machine goes very fast.
700 to 800 cans a minute.
From there, the cans are sent over to be boxed up and shrink-wrapped. And then they're put on a pallet in a warehouse with cans that go as far as you can see. That's where they wait before they head out to stores across Wisconsin, along with a few places in Illinois. Even with the pandemic, Rassel says Jolly Good has been doing well. But he says they've also got ground to make up with customers they missed when they had to stop selling.
If you do the math from 2007 to 2014, when we weren't on the shelves, we missed a generation.
Rassel says they have some help with that, though, from older generations who still know and love Jolly Good.
Part of it is that those older generations remembering the brand, remembering the memories, and wanting to recreate those memories with the younger generation. It's very impactful, this, you know, especially during this time.
That's where a lot of the brand's power comes from, the nostalgia people feel for it.
Whether it was camping, ball games, the lake house, the beach, you name it. Everyone, just kind of reached out, I remember drinking Jolly Good.
Rassel's uncle Bruce passed away before he had a chance to see Jolly Good come to life again. He says it was important to pay homage to him and his work building Jolly Good.
Hopefully he'd be proud. I think we did a pretty good job.
WPR's Rachel Vasquez brought us that story on Jolly Good Soda. It's part of the Wisconsin 101 Project, which tells our state's history through objects. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Now, the Green Bay Packers are enjoying some downtime after beating the Chicago Bears last Sunday to secure a number one seed going into the NFL playoffs. They finished the regular season with a 13-3 record as quarterback Aaron Rodgers had one of his best years, out of many good years, making him the top contender for the league's MVP award. The team announced this week that when the Packers take the field again, 6,000 fans will be able to watch the game at Lambeau Field, the first time most fans will be allowed in what's been a season unlike any other. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of the Packers' chances now in the playoff field? Is this a Super Bowl year? What has stuck out to you about the team's play this year? Do you miss seeing fans at Lambeau? If you have been a season ticket holder yourself, what's this year been like watching from home? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Ryan Wood is a Packers beat reporter for the Green Bay Press Gazette. Ryan, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hey, no problem. How's it going?
Pretty good. Now, there's something you touched on Twitter pretty recently, Ryan. It's been a year of a lot of serious news. It's been a week of a lot of serious news. Can you talk about the value of sports as something that gives us a break from time to time?
Yeah, you know, I just happened to see on Wednesday afternoon a tweet from a follower about how can we be talking about Packers during a time like this? And I think it's a very fair question. The Packers coordinators, all three of them, talked during the right as the unrest was happening in Washington, D.C., and it was a really weird dichotomy because on my Zoom screen, I'm talking with Nathaniel Hackett and Mike Pettine, and then on my TV, on mute, I have what's going on in Washington, D.C. So it's not something where I can just speak for myself. It's not something where I unplug and I'm not aware of what's going on in the world. But at the same time, the very function of sports is to provide that release. It's the design of sports to be able to have that great escape and for a few hours, just be able to unplug and to let your mind go somewhere else. And I think that it's never been more important than it's been recently. And, that's kind of what I said to this follower was, you know, I hear you, believe me, I hear you. It's tough. But it's nice to have.
Well, I have used the Packers in that way this year, I'll be honest. But let's get to the team now. Before we get into the details, I watch the Packers pretty close. Some sports like basketball, I kind of follow loosely, but then tune in more during playoff time. So if we've got listeners out there who are in that boat, they see the Packers are going into a playoff run, give us the Cliff's Note version of the season they just missed.
Well, it's kind of odd because on one hand, they're 13-3, identical to last year, same exact record. And yet this is a different team. And I think you just got another reminder of that today. Last year, 13-3 in 2019, this is a team that had two players voted to the Pro Bowl and only one All-Pro selection. That was a second team selection for David Bakhtiari. This year, so you're talking last year, very minimal individual recognition. It kind of took the league by surprise. This year, they're tied for the league lead with the Seattle Seahawks, the Kansas City Chiefs, and the Baltimore Ravens with seven Pro Bowlers. And then today, with the Associated Press All-Pro list that came out, they were tied with the Indianapolis Colts for the most with four first-team selections and also had a pair of second-team selections. So you're talking about same record, but a very different reality for this team that is having individual accolades and recognition just pour in late in this season. And it's just an example of this is a better team. There's no question about it. It's an MVP caliber quarterback, something they didn't have last year. Aaron Rodgers was a Pro Bowler last year, not an MVP. Devontae Adams having one of the single greatest, if not the single greatest, receiving season in Packers history. So between the two of them, they've really generated what might be the best offense overall in the league. And then defensively, for all the flack that side of the ball has gotten, they're a top 10 defense. They're ninth in the league in yards. They're 11th, just outside the top 10 in rushing defense. Look at their last two games. Their last two games against Derrick Henry held him to 98 yards, and then David Montgomery held him to 69 yards when he came in averaging 105 yards on the ground the previous four games. The last time the Packers had a top 10 defense in yards was 2010. You might remember that year the Packers won the Super Bowl. It was the last time that they were world champions. So they've got both sides of the ball clicking at a very high level. Obviously, the offense has been pretty much off the charts, but that defense, they're carrying a defense into the playoffs as well.
want to give a listen to one of the calls on one of many Aaron Rodgers' touchdown passes this season, this one against the Bears on Sunday.
Bears coming with the blitz. Rodgers sees it, floats it down the middle. It is caught. Valdes-Scantling going to go all the way. Touchdown, Green Bay. 72 yards.
I mean, this is just a genius year for Aaron Rodgers. Can you talk about this season he's just put together?
Well, genius is a really good word for it because, yes, he's got the arm, and you've seen his legs have been pretty spry as well for a guy that's 37 years old now. So he's got the physical athletic ability. But that mind, that mental side of the game, my goodness, it's been really impressive. And that's a great example. The play you just ran is a great example of the mind because that was not how the play was supposed to go. Aaron Rodgers changed the play at the line of scrimmage. Why did he do that? He saw that the Bears were disorganized getting lined up before the snap and that they left a linebacker on Marquez Valdes-Scantling. That's a linebacker on 4-3 speed. You don't do that and get away with it with Aaron Rodgers. So he had MVS go deep, and he had, you know, as a third down play, he had on the left side of the play, he had Davante Adams wide open for a first down. He didn't need to go deep, but he knew that MVS was going to beat his matchup. He's going to beat the linebacker. He did. He put the ball perfectly. MVS caught it, and it's a 72-yard touchdown. There's been so many times this season where Aaron Rodgers' mind has gotten his team into a better play to the point that after the game in Chicago, Matt LaFleur said he's learned to just trust the quarterback because that's what he does. And I think that mental side of the game is maybe been the most impressive aspect so far this season.
And just speaking of the mind in the game, you just mentioned Davante Adams, and it seems like there's a receiver who has the same, I guess, intellectual grasp on the game, apart from his physical talents, that makes him a good match for Aaron Rodgers.
Yeah, you're right. And he's, you know, I asked Nathaniel Hackett on Wednesday, what is it in his mind that makes Davante Adams so elite? And I think a lot of times when you talk about Davante Adams, you talk about the crisp, pristine route running. He's so precise with his routes. His release off the line of scrimmage is just second to none. Cornerbacks, they try to press him, but they can't jam him at the line of scrimmage. He's just got too much burst and kind of an innate ability to time when to turn that acceleration on to get past the DB. But what Nathaniel Hackett said that really impresses him is his flexibility. The fact that you can literally, you watch Davante Adams this season, he lines up everywhere. It's not a guy that just stays in one spot and he's always the wide right wide receiver. He's wide right, slot left, wide left. He's in trips. He's flexed on both sides. It's all over the place. And those are all different positions on a football field. I mean, it's all called receiver. But where you line up changes the position as a receiver. And the fact that he's able to play any of them, he's kind of like the queen on a chessboard. You can move him any which way and do whatever you want with him. And by doing that, you really dictate the matchup. So it's not just a really athletic, superb, elite receiver. It's a guy who knows every position on the field and is able to be moved and used in any which way because of it.
We're talking to Ryan Wood, Packers beat reporter for the Green Bay Press-Gazette, looking back at a special year for the team and ahead at the playoffs. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What has stuck out to you this year about the Packers? What do you think about their chances as they go into the playoffs, starting with a bye week? Is this the year they win another Super Bowl with Aaron Rodgers? And what do you want to know about playoff matchups? 800-642-1234 is the number. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk now with Ryan Wood, Packers beat reporter at the Green Bay Press-Gazette, looking back at the team's season ahead now to the playoffs. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, your questions, your hopes for the playoffs. 800-642-1234 is the number. Let's go to your calls now. Tom is with us in Burlington. Tom, hi.
To your point about Aaron Rodgers, I think he has terrific peripheral vision. I think that's part of his great ability. But what I wanted to talk about was this thing of the Ice Bowl fantasy that they have, that we can go out there and have no clothes on and beat Mother Nature. in 2010, I called up Pepper Burris. I got so mad. I was watching them. I think they were playing the New England. And I said, Pepper, why don't you put some clothes on those guys? And he described that Donald Driver in that game had gotten seizures. He got cramps in his legs or something very early in the game, and he was really ineffective. And Pepper described to me, he said, well, Donald doesn't think he can catch the ball unless he has bare arms. So I just wish they would get over this fantasy of not dressing up. You have to, because if you're cold, you get dehydrated, and your body sends the blood to places where it's cold, and you become really ineffective.
I gotcha, Tom. Dealing with the cold, now that is a big part of the home field advantage, potentially in January, Ryan. Talk about the cold factor at Lambeau, because they'll all be home games until the Super Bowl if they make it that far.
Hey, I hear you. It's no question about it. It's cold. It's cold out there. I think it does help when you live in it, as opposed to the New Orleans Saints if they come up here, or the Tampa Bay Buccaneers if they come up here. Not just practicing it and playing in it, but living in it is a big benefit because your body acclimates. Before coming up here to Green Bay, Wisconsin to cover the Packers, I moved here from South Carolina. It was a major, major physical reacclimation process to come up to the cold. But you know what? A couple years in, suddenly 20 degrees isn't that cold anymore. And so I can tell you, as far as the football player's perspective, certainly for the linemen, I think there's a macho type of tough guy aspect to this. But it is, for the skilled players, it is very much a football thing that they don't want anything between their arms and the ball. Running backs, they feel like it's easier for them to fumble, easier to have those defensive players strip the ball out and force fumbles if they've got an extra layer between their arms and the ball. Receivers, you mentioned Donald Driver, every receiver feels that way. They wear the gloves because it helps with the grip, but once they tuck that thing, they want it to be nice and firm and not have that extra layer. It's the same reason why you won't see quarterbacks wearing gloves on their throwing hand, because they want to feel the football. So defensive backs, same way. I mean, if they've got a chance for an interception, they don't want that to slip through their sleeves. They want to make sure it's the arm. So, the team functions at a very high level when it comes to nutrition. And there's a lot of things they do to keep these guys hydrated. And you're right, they've got to keep them hydrated for that cold, because if they don't, it's going to be a problem. But that's something it's never going to change. Players are always going to feel that way. And you're always going to see these guys go out there, and almost all of them are going to be sleeveless.
Thanks for that call, Tom. We'll go to Vivian in Green Bay now. Vivian, hi.
Two comments very quickly. The Vikings, Fran Tarkenton, was also said to have great peripheral vision, and I believe that's a talent, a skill that you can enhance. But I really wanted to mention Devontae Adams. I love watching him go in for a dive catch, because it seems to me he's always going in like a stuntman. He'll go in on his shoulder. He avoids going in on a chest. He rotates his body like a cat, which means he comes down on his back or his butt instead of on his knees, which is like another foot that the ball is advanced. So, yeah, I love to watch the run catches, but I sure do like when Adams dives.
Just another part of his game, Ryan.
His body contortions are something. It's just another testament to his athletic ability. The way that he's able to, he's got what you call quick twitch, and that's basically he's got an acceleration where he's able to move his body quicker than any of us. It's not just a straight line speed thing. Let's not forget that Devontae Adams only ran 4.56 at the combine. He said that he'd be a lot faster than that today. He'd be a 4.4 guy today, and if you watch him play, It's hard to disagree with him, but more than straight line speed, he's got acceleration. He's got burst where he's able to just move his body so quickly. As far as the peripheral vision thing with Aaron Rodgers, maybe the most impressive play that he's had this season, for me at least, was his 400th touchdown, which against the Philadelphia Eagles, his 400th career touchdown. If you look at the play, all he did on the play physically, all he did was just he threw the ball to Devontae Adams in the left flat, a quick pass, simple throw. it looked like he did almost nothing on the play. Davante Adams took it from the 9-yard line into the touchdown, beat Darius Slay, the quarterback for the Eagles, to the goal line. And it looked like he did nothing on the play until you realize that that wasn't at all what the play was supposed to be. The play was supposed to be a jet reverse to Al Lazard to the right side of the field. Why didn't they run that? Because right in nanoseconds, right before the snap, Aaron Rodgers saw two things. He saw from the right side of the field, his right peripheral, he saw Brandon Graham, the Eagles' defensive lineman, line up in what's called a 9 technique, which means he's very wide on the line of scrimmage. That type of alignment takes away the jet sweep to that side because it's a horizontal run that's meant to go wide. So that Aaron Rodgers knew that play wasn't going to happen. On the left side, simultaneously, he saw Darius Slay, who was in press coverage right in Davante Adams' face, back up 5 yards into off coverage as Alan Lazard started his motion. So he's seeing two things on opposite sides of the field at the same time, and he's able to mentally process, okay, this play is not going to work. Let's throw it to the opposite side where Davante Adams has some space and let him make a play. I'll never understand how he's able to see two things so far apart from the right and the left. So you're right. The peripheral vision is certainly a strength of his as well.
Just a few moments left, Ryan. I want to ask you the scariest possible matchup next weekend, not this current weekend. Mine, Tampa Bay, after what happened in the regular season. Very briefly, yours.
Yeah, it's got to be Tampa Bay, I think. And not just because of what happened in the regular season, but even now. And we talk about what's the advantage that the Packers have. It's that cold, right? Well, Tom Brady, I know it's the Tampa Bay Buccaneers and it's warm down there, but Tom Brady has played his entire life in the cold. There's no question Tom Brady can play in the cold. And then defense travels in the cold. And that Bucs defensive front gave the Packers offensive line fits in the regular season. It's a very, very good, one of the best, if not the best, defensive front in football. And it's one of the few times the Packers offensive line has actually struggled against the defensive front this entire year. So I think in terms of balance on the offensive side, with Tom Brady and Gronk and Mike Evans and all those skilled players around him in the defense. You look at the Los Angeles Rams, they've got a great defense.
We'll have to leave it there. Thanks to Ryan Wood, Packers beat reporter at the Green Bay Press Gazette. Join us for a look at the Packers season as they head into the playoffs. Coming up after the news, it's this week's edition of Food Friday. I'm Rob Barrett. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up Monday at 7 on The Morning Show, Kate Archer-Kent talks to state legislative leaders from both parties about proposals to deal with COVID-19 and its economic impact on Wisconsin. That's Monday morning at 7 here on the Ideas Network. Now it's Food Friday. For many Midwestern families, casseroles hold a special place in our hearts and kitchens. Not always the most glamorous of foods, it's an easy, efficient way to feed a lot of people, or just a few people, and have some leftovers. And it's warm, gooey comfort food, especially in the wintertime. Wisconsin comedian Charlie Behrens tackled a casserole-related issue early last year.
Today we're making a dish that some of yous will call hot dish and some of yous will call casserole. But all yous will argue over which one is right and which one's a Vikings fan. Now me, I'm one of 12 kids, okay? I was mass-produced. So I grew up eating casseroles all the time. Every night was like one of them potlucks in the church basement.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have casseroles been a big part of your life as a child or last week? Do you have a casserole that reminds you of home? Do you try to revamp some classic Wisconsin casserole recipes? What is your go-to? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Megan Hill is the executive chef and head of the Culinary Hill Test Kitchen, a website for modern home cooking with a Midwestern heart. Megan was born and raised in Wisconsin. Megan, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me, Rob.
Well, you've got a big casserole selection on your website. Were casseroles part of your dinner table growing up?
Absolutely. I think my mom made them at least once a week.
Do you have a favorite one from childhood memory?
So from childhood memories, my favorite one would be tuna casserole. So it's egg noodles, creamy sauce. My mama always put cheese on it too. And then obviously tuna and peas.
And now I think we think of casseroles as this, you know, humble Midwestern thing. Looking at your website, I'm reminded a lot of different things fit the bill. I know chilaquiles I make an inauthentic version of at home. That's like a Mexican casserole, right? Like there's a lot of casseroles around the world, not just the stuff we think of here in the Midwest.
That's exactly right. And it doesn't always have to be noodle-based like most of the ones I grew up with. Sometimes they have tater tots or potatoes and rice. There's all different ways you can make them.
Your website, as I mentioned, you focus on modern home cooking with a Midwestern heart. What kind of things do you do when you take a look at a classic Midwestern recipe and try to, you know, put a new spin on it or freshen it up for the 21st century?
So I do not consider myself a food snob, so I would never shun certain ingredients like Velveeta cheese. And I don't necessarily have a problem with canned goods. Like if you think of cream of mushroom soup, I don't personally use it because I think making it from scratch tastes better. But I will use Cool Whip when it applies, not in a casserole. But when we revamp recipes for a modern home cook, we're really leading with a compass of what tastes the best. And then just keeping in mind that people have a lot more access to ingredients than they used to. You know, I remember when I was in high school, I had to go to a specialty grocery store to find something like mirin, which is an Asian ingredient. And now Target, Walmart, and every grocery store has it. So there's a lot more access than we used to have.
Now, before we get to some specific casserole recipes, I want to talk about your website a little bit. I don't usually do this, but I really like when you've got a recipe, you know, you don't have a 10-chapter biography leading up to it. You say a few lines about it. You get into it. You show pictures. And then there's this print-friendly thing. And I'm like, I'm going to be cooking stuff from here. What were you trying to accomplish with the website? Because it seems Rob-friendly anyway, user-friendly in general.
Streamlined. So we're trying to make the best possible user experience. Sometimes there's a little bit of story in the beginning, but not much. I know people don't want that. Obviously, the internet is full of memes of people that hate food bloggers because we all talk about the summer that we were in Italy and learned how to make this dish. And nobody wants to hear that. So I only add context when I think it's really important. But otherwise, it's really, what do you need to know? What are the straight facts and get you to the recipe? And there is a jump to recipe button at the top if you want to skip the process shots and our information, you can go straight to the card. I think you can even print from the recipe title. So it's really about getting people what they want. So thank you for noticing.
It's Food Friday. We're talking about casseroles with Megan Hill, executive chef for the Culinary Hill Test Kitchen. She has shared a few recipes with us. You could share your casserole memories, distant or recent, and your favorites, or maybe a question at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Now, we've got a few recipes that Megan shared with us. We've got these up at wpr.org/foodfriday. And the first one, hey, there it is from your childhood, Megan, the tuna noodle casserole. Now, in this one, you say you can use the can of soup, but you've got your own cream sauce. What goes into that?
So it's usually like a roux, you know, flour, butter, some kind of fat. And then this one, you know, might be different than other ones, but you can use milk or cream. So it's just something to make that creamy sauce. And I think the most important thing about that is you need to taste it before you build your casserole, because if your sauce is not seasoned properly, you know, if you like hot sauce, put it in then before you add the noodles and bake it. The saddest thing that I could think is that somebody might have a bland casserole. So when you make that sauce, that's your chance to make it your own. So I just encourage people to do that. So in my case, this one's using heavy cream, but you can, you know, you can try it with milk if you feel comfortable, but just make sure that you use enough salt and pepper and whatever else you think would make it taste good. If it's in the pot and you taste it and it tastes delicious, then you know you're on track.
And you've got a little crunch on this one, as casseroles often do. What do you do to make the tuna noodle casserole crunch a bit?
So I love Ritz crackers as a crunch. You can also use cornflakes are so good. You can make breadcrumbs, but I think Ritz crackers are really nice because they just have that nice buttery flavor, and it's pure nostalgia for me. So my mom always made a vegetable casserole for Thanksgiving every year. Well, she still does. And it has Ritz crackers. So it's just, for me, I have to do it. It's a go-to.
And a lot of your recipes, most of your recipes, I think, have some variations at the end, so you can try different things. What kind of things might we do with this recipe? Maybe even subbing in something else for the tuna. How can we mix this one up a little?
So this is a great, what you could use this base casserole and use your leftover chicken. If you buy one of those rotisserie chickens and you have some left, use it here. If it's, you know, if we just finished Thanksgiving and you have some leftover turkey, this is perfect for that. So you could also just add more vegetables and leave the meat out if that's your kind of thing. So there's a lot of options.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. We've got Eric on the line in Lake Tomahawk. Eric, hi.
Well, hi there. I just thought I'd mention my experience with casseroles and chicken soup. I, a good Catholic family, 8 kids. I was the second oldest, and I was 27 years old before I found out that tuna casserole had tuna in it, and chicken soup, I don't know, had chicken. I was fascinated. So that's my comment.
Well, hold on, Eric. What were you thinking was going on here when they said it was tuna casserole?
I don't know. I thought it was kind of a name.
I love it. Now, is this something, do you still like tuna casserole now, Eric, since you made your, since you got the big reveal and found out what was in it?
Well, when I started making it with tuna, I liked it a whole lot better.
Okay. Eric, thanks a lot for sharing that. Yeah, sometimes that's, you know, with a casserole, it's just casserole, and maybe as kids we don't think about what's actually in it. I don't know. What do you think, Megan?
I could totally see that happening. I do think it's interesting that, like, mine even has chicken broth in it, and it's really adding that meaty flavor that people want. So tuna on its own might not make the sauce be super savory and rich. So I think chicken broth adds there. But yes, I mean, my mom made something that she called conglomeration, which was just sort of a catch-all for it. I mean, most of the time it was ground beef or ground venison. And then sometimes it was cream of celery based, and sometimes it was tomato sauce based. Always had a noodle, and it always had cheese. And we called it conglomeration, and I still love it. It's amazing.
Can we do casseroles? Like, I think of soup. Like, soup for me is like, how do I use up these little bits of things that on their own aren't going to make up a meal? Can we approach our casseroles like that? Like, clear the fridge efforts?
Like a kitchen sink casserole. I mean, absolutely. That's the great thing is, you know, you can look at, okay, how much meat is in a recipe, how much, you know, vegetable is in a recipe. And you just, you know, and in this case, in the case of tuna casserole, I have some mushrooms and some peas. But if you don't like those and you don't have them, you can use whatever you want. I mean, I would think something like carrots, for example, you would probably want to cook those down a little because they might not, you know, be soft enough in the final dish. So you just have to think about that. But otherwise, yes, clean out the crisper and make the casserole of your dreams. Definitely.
We got an email from Grant who says, I love soubise. And that's S-O-U-B-I-S-E, a savory baked casserole using loads of caramelized onions plus rice and cheese. Truly addictive. Grant says Marion Cunningham has a great one. She calls first prize onion casserole. So do you do some caramelized onion casserole action, Megan?
I have never done that. It sounds like something that I need to get into. I wonder if it's more like a thickened version of French onion soup. I'm for sure going to look into onion casseroles. I've never had that. It sounds perfect.
I'd never heard of it. So thank you, Grant, for opening my mind there. We are talking with Megan Hill on this week's edition of Food Friday. Megan's executive chef and head of the Culinary Hill Test Kitchen. It's a website for modern home cooking with a Midwestern heart. We are talking about casseroles. You can find her website, culinaryhill.com. We've got a few recipes up from her at wpr.org/foodfriday. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a casserole memory to share? Do you have a family favorite from last week or from 20 years ago? Are you pro casserole? Are they what you served a company or a big family? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the Food Friday conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we're picking up our Food Friday talk with Megan Hill, executive chef and head of the Culinary Hill Test Kitchen. She is from Wisconsin. You can join in at 800-642-1234. We are talking about casseroles. Do you have a favorite to make now? Do you have a favorite casserole memory maybe from your childhood? Or do you have a question for our guest? 800-642-1234 is a number. That's 800-642-1234. We'll go back to your calls now. Rick is with us in Cambridge. Rick, hi.
Hi, how are you? Good afternoon. And good afternoon to your host, your guest, rather. I had a question for you. I was originally from New England, so my growing up, casseroles were king, of course. I mean, that's what everything was with casserole. And I've lived in Wisconsin now for over 40 years. And out here, as far as I can tell, everything is a hot dish, not a casserole. Do you think there's a difference between those two, or is that specific to the Midwest, Wisconsin?
Rick, thanks for that call. We heard Charlie Barron's raising that question earlier. Megan, hot dish versus casserole. Is there a dividing line?
Okay, so I actually was having this conversation with a friend 2 days ago. We were trying to figure it out. She lives in Iowa. It's my understanding that hot dish is a Minnesota thing and casserole is a Wisconsin thing, but maybe my division line is wrong based on your caller. He's in Wisconsin and he hears the term hot dish. So is there anyone out there that can settle this for us? Because it might be keeping people up at night.
We might need our research team at Wisconsin to check that out. I don't know. I hear hot dish in Wisconsin, but not everywhere. 800-642-1234. If you feel you have a definitive answer to that question or just some casserole thoughts of your own, we'll go to Justin now in Verona. Justin, hi.
Hey, good afternoon.
What do you want to bring up, Justin?
Yeah, sorry, I can't help you on the hot dish versus casserole aspect, but I do have a sauerkraut kielbasa casserole that my mom passed my recipe to me. Very simple, very tasty, very easy. It's only got four ingredients. You know, you got sauerkraut on the bottom, drained. I like Bavarian style. I kind of like the sweetness to it. And then you got a layer of ring sausage or, you know, kielbasa, something like that. And then you do a layer of like cream of mushroom or cream of chicken, cream of onion would work. And then you put French fries on top, and then that's it. You just bake it.
Wow. Okay. And this is good. This is good stuff. I've never had this before. I love kielbasa and sauerkraut and fries.
Yeah. And then you add in, you know, the meat, obviously, and you get the crunch and saltiness from the French fries on top. Like, it's fantastic.
Justin, thanks a lot. Kielbasa, Megan, as the heart of a casserole. Have you heard of that that particular
yes.
combination?
I've definitely heard of sauerkraut casserole. So with the interesting thing here for me that gets me so excited is the cream of soup with the French fries. I feel like this is sort of a twist on poutine. Am I overreaching here? I don't know. That's just what I envisioned in my head.
Interesting.
But it's
thanks
the wrong
a lot.
Order. It's in the wrong order, but upside down sauerkraut poutine.
Yeah, okay, there you go. Thanks a lot for sharing that with us. That sounds pretty good. Hey, let's check out another one that you shared with us, Megan. We've got it up at WPR.org/FoodFriday. This one you have to be a little more premeditated about, an overnight breakfast casserole. Tell us about this guy.
So this one is from my best friend who lives in Minnesota, from her mother. She gave this to me, and I was so excited about it when I tried it the first time. So it's basically layers of bread with ham and cheese and some spices in between. You cover the whole thing, and I think it's like 10 eggs mixed with milk. You let it sit overnight, the bread softens, and then right before you bake it, you add a buttery cornflake topping. And I used to host a lot of brunches, and I'd have parties just so I could make this. It's one of my most favorite recipes. It is absolutely delicious.
And you could vary this depending on the bread you use. You could switch up different breakfast meats. I could see this going a lot of different ways.
Yes, that's what I love about casseroles, is there's so much flexibility. And if you're just like, I don't like ham, then put in something else that you do like. You could make so many versions, and it's delicious.
Thanks a lot for that call. It's Food Friday. We're talking about casserole with Megan Hill, originally from Wisconsin, executive chef and head of the Culinary Hill Test Kitchen. Got some recipes from Megan at WPR.org/FoodFriday. Ben joins us next in West Salem. Ben, hi.
Hey, we're just listening, me and a couple friends that are cooks, chefs, whatever you want to call it, but we live in the Mississippi River Valley region, so we're on the Wisconsinites, but you get a lot of Minnesota, Wisconsin crossing back and forth for jobs, families, and honestly, it really doesn't matter. It's all the same thing. It really depends on how you use the word. Like, our parents will say, well, we're having a casserole if we're at home. But let's say you're going to a potluck or church or something, you'd say we're taking a hot dish to pass. Or you're going over to a friend's house for a Packer game, and you know, so they can beat the Vikings. You're going to say, bring a hot dish to pass, you know. And it really is so relative, and that's kind of how we see it. It just matters how you use the word and where you're maybe going, but the food, you might call your tater tot casserole a hot dish to pass, depending on what you're doing, you know?
Interesting. Ben, thanks a lot. It's not the dish. It's, I guess, where you're serving it, Megan.
I love this. I love that these people are as invested in this conversation as I am. Thank you so much. Yeah, and I think that makes a lot of sense. I know ultimately it's the same thing. I know that those, it's like those two terms are used interchangeably, and I think it makes sense that maybe refer to one when you're taking it and one when you're eating it at home. I think that's brilliant.
And that's thanks for that call. That speaks to the portability of the hot dish or casserole. Like, it's an easy thing to pre-make, and as long as there's going to be oven space where you're going to reheat and serve. So it's a food that travels well, right?
I would agree. And I think if you can take a little bit of a risk and practice a little bit, it could also be very slow cooker friendly, because think about, you know, if you have your noodles that are cooked and you have this sauce, if you have enough time to heat it up at your destination, it could also work really well that way.
Let's go back to our callers. Kathy is with us in Baldwin. Kathy, hello.
Hi. I wonder if it's a heritage thing. Our Lutheran church cookbook, and it's mostly old German heritage, is full of hot dish. There's not a casserole in it.
But if you served these things to me, Kathy, and I didn't know what you called them, I might call them a casserole?
Yeah, I think so. I think it's just how you were raised, and I wonder if it's heritage.
Interesting. I think that could be, you might be onto something there, Kathy. Thanks a lot for the call. I appreciate that. Megan, I want to, before we run out of time, check out your chicken spaghetti casserole, again with a homemade mushroom sauce.
Yeah, so this is sort of along the same lines as the tuna noodle one. You have noodles, and of course you could vary. If you don't want to use spaghetti, you could use something else, but there's chicken. So you can either cook it on the spot, or you can use your leftover chicken. And then again, just make sure that you season your sauce. Otherwise, you're going to have a bad time. So yeah, this one's really fun. I love it.
Cool. Now, casseroles, you know, I think we think of them as heavy, maybe not the most health-oriented foods. Is there something, such a thing as a health casserole, a light casserole?
So you can absolutely do that, but I think it misses the point. So unless there's some reason that you have to do that, I would say just save it for a special occasion. And maybe the special occasion is every Sunday. But, you know, of course you could use alternative milks and things like that. But I think it really gets away from what, you know, the joy that is casserole. So I don't really recommend it, but if you want to dabble in that...
We've had some people posting on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Ryan weighed in on the hot dish versus casserole debate. He writes, my wife's family calls it hot dish. She's from Wisconsin. My family used to call it goulash. I'm from New York. I call it using up the leftovers. I love it. Now, goulash, I think of that as a specifically Hungarian thing. And I think you had a goulash in your casserole section on your website, right, Megan?
I do, but it is not the official Hungarian one. So this is sort of, sometimes I get angry comments on my site. The goulash on my site is closer to the conglomeration that my mom made when I was growing up. I think of it as a Midwestern goulash. It is not at all authentic. It's sort of like a chili mac, but with different spices. So I do have a goulash, but it is not the one you're thinking of. It is more generic and like specific to the Midwest.
And you write on a couple of your recipes, like you've got a Puerto Rican one, I think, that's inspired by Puerto Rico, but you're very clear up front. This is not, you're not shooting for an authentic recipe here.
I try to clear if it's not authentic and I don't really know much about, you know, whatever it is, I try to just, you know, stay away from that or declare it up front. Yes.
Well, Megan, thank you so much for joining us. It's been a lot of fun today.
Thank you so much, Rob. I had a blast.
Megan Hill is the executive chef and head of the Culinary Hill Test Kitchen, a website for modern cooking with a Midwestern heart. Megan was born and raised in Wisconsin. You can find three casserole recipes she shared with us today. They are at WPR.org/Food Friday. Coming up Monday here on Central Time, we'll get the latest news in U.S. politics after a turbulent week and look ahead at the upcoming Biden administration and the challenges facing it. Communities and neighborhoods around the country formed mutual aid groups to help each other out during the pandemic. We'll meet some of the people leading those efforts around Wisconsin. And did you take any great photos during 2020? It was a good hobby for social distancing. A photographer joins the show, and you can share your stories. That's Monday on Central Time. Hey, do you have a second? Well, if you do, you might have to give it back. It turns out the Earth has spun a little faster than average lately, and that might mean that international timekeepers could add a negative leap second somewhere along the way. Here's the deal. The Earth spins at a pretty regular rate, but as reported at Live Science, it has a little wiggle room. So one day can vary from another by a few milliseconds. That can result from little variations in things like the Earth's core or some drag from the atmosphere. Now, milliseconds is no big deal, but a lot of the fastest days on record happened last year, and those milliseconds can start to add up. Again, for our daily lives, not a big deal. But a lot of digital technology, navigation, astronomy, and other applications need time to be really consistent. Now, we have leap years to keep our Earth calendar lined up with our solar calendar, and we've had leap seconds added from time to time to keep our clocks lined up with the atomic clocks that we rely on for the super accurate timekeeping. But thanks to all those speedy days, some scientists are talking about going in the other direction with a negative leap second. Now, don't go and set your clocks and watches back just yet. The idea is still in the debate stage. There's still time to second guess. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.